You're listening to the Evolvement Podcast with your boy, Nye, where cryptocurrency, Bitcoin, and our financial future are the hot topics.
That is the future.
Thank you for tuning in. And now, get ready. We are going live in 3, 2, 1.
What is going on, everybody? What is going on? And welcome to another episode of the Evolvement Podcast with your boy, Nye. We are here to talk about Bitcoin, cryptocurrency, and the future of our financial systems. And today, I have a super special guest on the line with me today. I have Brock Pierce. Brock is an avid entrepreneur, an avid creative mind. Everybody has heard of Brock Pierce if you are in the cryptocurrency space. And I'm really excited to have you on, Brock. Welcome.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yeah, no problem, man. No problem. It's been really cool to meet you. We first met in Korea and very brief, but spoke for a little bit and met at other parts of the world, going to all these cryptocurrency conferences and things like that. And I enjoy your presence, man. I enjoy the energy that you bring to a space. It's very calm and always kind of evolutionary and kind of futuristic when we have conversations. So I'm excited to have you on the chat today.
Yeah, well, I'm excited to be here. Lots to discuss. And, we're 1 month into 2019. And I'm very excited about the year ahead.
100%. 100%. Me too, man. Me too. I think that we've seen some big changes over the last couple of years. I'm excited to see what happens. So before we get into anything in terms of Mt. Gox, in terms of the future of cryptocurrency or all of these things that we're going to talk about, Puerto Rico and things like that, can you just start off by giving the people a little introduction of yourself? What were you doing before cryptocurrency? What got you inspired to get into this industry? And what are you working on right now that's really exciting for you?
Yeah, well, I've reinvented myself a number of times. And I guess the lesson there is, whatever any of us is doing in our lives, we always have the power and the ability to say, I've done that. And I want to go do something new. We all have that ability. And sometimes, we forget that because we get caught up in whatever it is that we're doing and we become trapped by that habit, that comfort of the known versus the unknown. And so I've made a habit of, reinventing myself and exploring, new things throughout my life. I grew up in the entertainment business and, then went into entrepreneurship as a teenager during the internet 1.0 back in 1997, 98, 99, as kind of, we had our first big, dot-com bubble and, learned a lot from that period. And then I ended up in the digital currency space. In late 99, at least identifying the market opportunity, but it became my full-time focus in 2001, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, et cetera. And in that area, I was making a market for virtual currencies in games. So if you'd ever played a game like World of Warcraft or Second Life or EverQuest or Lineage or any of these sorts of things, I had identified that the intangible assets or objects in those persistent worlds were alienable, were transferable. And because the environments were persistent, they therefore had value, meaning you could accumulate digital goods in these games and there were people that were willing to pay money, real money for those things. And that market existed because some people had expendable income but lacked discretionary time and others, the opposite, where they had too much time but lacked expendable income and therefore a market was made primarily in time. And the reason people would buy these things is because it would improve their game in some way. It would improve the utility of their gameplay or their social status, the same reasons we buy things in the analog world. And so I became the world's main market maker for digital currencies and virtual goods and games, built up a supply chain of about 400,000 people in China in the early 2000s that would play games like World of Warcraft for us to mine those digital currencies that we would then sell all over the world. Also, was PayPal's largest merchant for years. We were Google's largest advertiser for a little while. We helped launch Alipay. And so we got very good at cross-border payments, dealing with digital currencies, understanding, you know, the world's markets. We were the biggest in South Korea. We had over 90% market share in South Korea for a long time. And so that was kind of the main precursor for me, that led to me being as active as I am in this space. Though I've done a number of other things as well, you know, built television channels, advised governments, you know, all sorts of stuff. I'm, you know, call it ADD, and always, you know, looking to learn new things. But that's what led me to this space, was the game stuff more than anything else. And in the crypto space, I've been full-time, kind of dropping everything else that I had been working on in late 2012. By 2013, I was starting a new company, call it every 60 days, until I had started a bunch of them and realized there's only so many things that you can manage at one time, at a mediocre level. I realized if I wanted to run things and do things well, I couldn't continue to build more businesses. I was doing call it a poor job. Though created some interesting stuff along the way. We started a company called GoCoin, which was one of the early payment processors. Started a company called Blade, which was putting crypto, you know, onto credit card rails, Visa, MasterCard, Amex. Did that with Ed Boyle, who had been the founder of the prepaid division of Amex for 7 years and ran that as general manager. Started a thing called Tether, which most people know if you're in the space, where we put the first real world asset on the blockchain, and that does $1 trillion or $2 trillion a year of trading volume right now, with over 2 billion of, you know, US dollars behind it. Started Blockchain Capital, which was the first dedicated fund to the ecosystem. Co-founded MasterCoin, where we invented the ICO, or did the first ICO. Handful of other things kind of early on. Then I stopped focusing on the entrepreneurial stuff for a little while, and was really just focused on the Blockchain Capital activities, and, you know, essentially was acting as a full-time VC, funding, you know, lots and lots and lots of companies, you know, providing the resources to entrepreneurs through the last major bear market that they needed to be able to innovate and build. And since we were in a bear market, I spent that time just providing resources at a time there was essentially no one funding companies, very similar to where we are right now, except for you now have 10 or 20 funds that are dedicated to the space. At the time, you only had three. You know, it was Blockchain Capital, DCG, and Pantera. You know, there were only three groups funding essentially all the innovation in the crypto space in 2014 and 15, because the ICO market hadn't, you know, developed into anything meaningful yet. The first ICO was back in the summer of 2013, but it wasn't popularized until after Ethereum, and really the DAO. The DAO was the first big, you know, sort of ICO that opened up everyone's eyes to the potential of an ICO, that this might be a better form of financing, or a better way of accumulating resources for a project than raising venture capital. Prior to the DAO, venture capital was the preferred method of pretty much all the entrepreneurs. You know, on the Blockchain Capital side, then we did the first STO. I was running one of the top 10 syndicates on AngelList, and I was playing a lot with crowdfunding because I was very interested in how the Jobs Act legislation was going to impact capital formation. And so I was an early advisor to Distilled Jeans. I think they were the second Reg A offering ever. And then I was very active on AngelList and other platforms trying to understand how this new legislation was going to impact early stage finance. And that eventually led to me saying, I think you're going to see a convergence between, you know, crowdfunding and blockchain. And I had been talking to people about the idea of creating a, you know, a security token for about a year, year and a half, and encouraging people to try it. Well, at Blockchain Capital, and no one really seemed to like the idea. And so I convinced my partners at Blockchain Capital to do it. And so, back in the spring of 2017, we did the first STO called BCAP. And after that, I kind of felt my time as a VC was over. I did everything I wanted to do. I supported entrepreneurs through the bear market of 2014 and 15 and into 16. As the ICO market was taking off, I was able to do the first STO, and that was kind of the last box I needed to check on the venture side before going back into entrepreneurship. And so I stepped down from Blockchain Capital and joined some friends to start a company called Block One, where we where Dan Larimer and team, we built a thing called EOS and brought EOS to market through a very interesting ICO or token sale that went for a year. And, you know, I'm back to building things again these days. I guess what was the last part of your question? Kind of.
Yeah. Like what are you working on right now? That's like really caught your attention that's got you excited about the space or excited about whatever you're working on.
There's a few things that are kind of, you know, taking up my mind share right now. I'm sticking just to the blockchain sort of stuff, not things outside of it. I also started the first crypto bank, called Noble Markets or Noble Bank in 2014 out of Puerto Rico. And that's because banking was a problem for crypto companies. And if you needed a bank account and you were, you know, call it an early crypto exchange, you know, you most likely went into a bank and lied about the nature of your business, which is a felony. And so I saw that as an existential threat to the ecosystem that, you know, almost everyone was in a very, very gray, if not darker area, in how banking was operating because banks weren't willing to support most of our activities at the time and were very threatened by it. And so I wanted to try and solve that problem for the benefit of the ecosystem. So I continue to be very focused on banking again. I've been very active the last year around sort of what can be done around banking. I continue to be very active in, call it, the security token market and how that ecosystem develops. I help most of the, call it, security token platforms in the space in some capacity, some more than others. You know, T0 obviously being one of the platforms I'm very interested in, obviously Securitize as well. I continue to be very interested in the security token market. Also, you know, spending a lot of time right now on Mt. Gox, but we'll, I think, take a deeper dive into that in a moment. And kind of what's next, where crypto meets philanthropy, you know, how do we use these, you know, systems to make the world a better place? I ultimately believe that that's what, you know, this technology is here to do. Not to say that there's not going to be benefits to those, you know, early participants from a monetary perspective or value perspective, but, you know, money isn't what motivates me. And so I spent a lot of my time focused on, you know, how this technology can be used for positively impacting the world at large. And so that's taking up a lot of my time. I'm always busy doing, you know, so many things. But I'd say those are the general themes. You know, continue to focus on banking, continue to focus on, you know, how the sort of the next evolution of the market, security tokens, and then sort of impact. I tend to do a lot of the thankless work, the jobs that, you know, are not profitable. And so no one else wants to do them. You know, jobs like the Bitcoin Foundation, jobs like the EOS Alliance, jobs like the philanthropic efforts. I like big challenges. That's what motivates me. And specifically the things that, you know, not everybody else is doing. If a bunch of people are trying to solve a specific problem, the market doesn't really need my help there. If there's already multiple groups of people trying to solve, you know, a problem, all I want to do is, you know, help them do what they're doing. I don't need to go create another company doing the same thing as five other groups. That's not, I prefer to be a trendsetter than follower.
Yeah, it just ends up not being overly productive. I can see that. I can understand that.
Because I'm not competitive. I don't really believe in competition. I believe that if anyone succeeds in making the world a better place, we all win. And so if there's already, you know, multiple smart groups of people trying to solve a particular problem, you know, my preferred approach is to help them solve that problem and be of service to them in the ways that I can. You know, the projects that I focus meaningful time and effort on are the things where I don't see, you know, problems being solved, like putting a real world asset on the blockchain, you know, with Tether, or creating a security token. No one else was doing these things at the time. I just want to help everybody that's out there doing things that are already identified as things that need to be done.
I love it, man. I love it. I love the mentality that you have, and it even for lack of a better word, it radiates off of you. You know, it radiates off of you when you speak. It radiates off of you when you're at events and things like that. And it sounds like you've had a very, very interesting journey in life so far. So it's cool to hear all that. And as we're moving kind of like, I want to get really deep in and or as deep as we can into the future impact and the future role this plays, cryptocurrency plays on the entire world and things like that. But I think the first step that I really want to discuss is the Mt. Gox situation. So for people who may be unfamiliar or who have a little information on it, can you just give a description of what the Mt. Gox situation is, why it's relevant to the entire space? And what's going on with it right now?
Of course. Let's start with Neil Stephenson. Let's start with Snow Crash. Japan has, you know, played an important role in the development of this ecosystem, more so than most people give Japan credit for. The creators of Bitcoin chose the identity of Satoshi Nakamoto. They chose a Japanese name for the creator of Bitcoin. You know, they chose the land of the rising sun as, you know, the place that Bitcoin would be born, at least in terms of its namesake as the creator. And so I'm often tipping my hat to Japan, because Satoshi did. And the first major crypto exchange also happened to come out of Japan with Mt. Gox. And Mt. Gox has always been kind of near and dear to me. Remember, Mt. Gox was created in 2007, before Bitcoin, before the Bitcoin white paper. It stands for Magic the Gathering Online Exchange. So Jed McCaleb, the founder of Ripple and Stellar, was also the founder of Mt. Gox. He created it originally as a site to trade Magic the Gathering cards, virtual Magic the Gathering cards. So Jed was playing around in my old industry, again, the market for buying and selling and trading virtual currencies and virtual goods inside of online games. That wasn't very successful, and so he pivoted to Bitcoin. And Mt. Gox then became the most important Bitcoin exchange in the world, by far the 800-pound gorilla. You know, it became synonymous with Bitcoin over 2010, 11, 12, and was responsible for, you know, the rise of, you know, Bitcoin in price more so than probably anything else. You know, 2013, when we had that first major bull market, where we ran up to $1,000. So, you know, the rise of Mt. Gox also played a very, very important role in the development of our ecosystem. And that too, you know, came out of Japan. So we had the rise of Mt. Gox, and then obviously for most people, they remember the fall, because the fall of Mt. Gox is, you know, what became one of the biggest stories in the world, you know, on par with Enron, on par with the failing of Lehman Brothers, on par with the failing of Bear Stearns. You know, 2014 and the collapse of Mt. Gox, you know, is how most people heard about Bitcoin. most people's first interaction and first perception of Bitcoin was in the context of Mt. Gox failing, which is why if you were in this space back in 2014 and you were talking to someone about Bitcoin, their first reaction usually was, oh, that thing where everyone loses their money. Oh, that thing that isn't safe. Oh, that thing. I mean, everyone's, you know, a huge number of people, their first interaction, their first perception of Bitcoin was negative. And it was associated with something that isn't secure and isn't safe, which is entirely inaccurate. But the media tends to sensationalize things and people don't really do much in the way of research. They get most of their news from the headlines, the clickbait solely. But the first perception of Bitcoin was negative. The polls that we did back then was that there was a 96% overlap amongst people that had heard of Bitcoin and heard of Mt. Gox. Literally, Mt. Gox and Bitcoin were almost 100% synonymous. They were almost the same word in terms of perception. Most people don't remember how big a deal Mt. Gox was and how big a role it played in our ecosystem and how most people at the time, their first perception of Bitcoin was through Mt. Gox. So when Mt. Gox failed, I got very involved in the process. In late 2012, early 2013, I almost bought Mt. Gox. I was going to roll it up into my old video game company that was primarily financed by Goldman Sachs. My investors at the time were not a fan of me buying the biggest Bitcoin exchange in the world, considering that my main investors were major banks. went through that process, then went and looked at doing it personally, then went and set up mtgox.cn. And I was forming a joint venture with Mark Karpeles at the time to basically bring Bitcoin to China. Asia wasn't really into crypto yet, other than Mt. Gox in Japan. There wasn't really a Korean market. There wasn't much of a Chinese market. But I had done so much business in China, I figured and explained to Mark Karpeles at the time, let me bring Mt. Gox into China, let me be your joint venture partner, and let me have an option to buy you. He said, that sounds great. We went forward in putting that deal together. I decided not to move forward with that at the time. I'll spare all the details. The main thing being concerns about, you know, how well the exchange was run. And I had concerns that I couldn't have, I didn't want to be dependent upon Mt. Gox and its back end for my exchange. I thought that was a risk factor that was too large. Fortunately, I was right and didn't go down that path. But fast forward, I was giving a talk at Jason Calcanis's launch event in San Francisco the day that Mt. Gox failed. It was the first time that Jason had anyone talk about Bitcoin. And so I'd just gotten off stage giving a speech. And all of a sudden, my phone's blowing up with Mt. Gox, Mt. Gox, Mt. Gox. So I call up Mark Karpeles. I said, hey, Mark, I'd like to buy the exchange. And he's like, what? I said, yeah, I'd like to buy the exchange. He goes, are you not watching the news? I said, that's why I'm calling. And he goes, and you're still interested? I said, well, yeah, the terms have obviously changed, but it looks like you're going to need some help from, you know, professionals that know how to solve big problems. And you're probably in over your head. And he was like, yeah. So negotiated a deal to buy Mark Karpeles's 88% of the equity at the time. Negotiated a deal to buy the 12% from Jed McCaleb, you know, the original founder that sold it to Mark. And so I did a deal to buy 100% of the equity of Mt. Gox back in 2014. So I've been very involved with this. Then through the bankruptcy liquidation, we went and did deals with both of the class action parties. We put together the first civil rehabilitation plan, submitted to the bankruptcy courts and blah, 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 lots of stuff. And then Japan clearly was very, very slow. The trustee was going to need a lot of time to understand this. And this was clearly going to become a minimum of a multi-year process. And so, started scaling back the amount of time and energy that I was putting into this to focus on blockchain capital and EOS and security tokens and a dozen other things that I've done in the meantime. But I've been, you know, throughout this entire Mt. Gox bankruptcy, I've been following it closely. I'm obviously have a huge vested interest in it. You know, I arguably still own 100% of the equity. And I became very focused on it when the price of Bitcoin increased in a huge way. You know, as someone that arguably owns the equity and Bitcoin being, you know, at the price that it's at, you know, there's about $1.2 to $1.3 billion there. In the bankruptcy process, the creditors were only entitled to $400 and change per Bitcoin, which means there's net assets there of about $700 million that arguably goes to the equity, meaning I might be looking at a $700 million windfall personally. So clearly I've been paying close attention. I'm not interested in any of that. I wouldn't ever take any of that money, not one penny, not 1 cent, because I don't think that's right. Even if I legally would be entitled to it, I would never take it. Just because the bankruptcy trustee at the time had to mark to market and do the things that traditional financial markets have to do doesn't mean that creditors don't deserve it all. Creditors deserve all of that $1.2 to $1.3 billion. I would never take 1 cent of it. But the fact that that became a potential reality clearly made me very focused on this. And somehow, even though all the press is out there about what I did in 2014 and bought it, the media never reported on it. It's literally like no one does any research. And everybody started talking about, whoa, Mark Karpeles might get $700 million. Wow, Mark Karpeles might get $700 million. No, this is horrible. This is horrible. This is horrible. And no one was really looking at the fact that, you know, I might own all of it. and that's why I've primarily gotten very engaged. I want to make sure that the right things happen here. I want to make sure that the creditors get all of that money, which I believe that they're entitled to. And that's why this has become a focus again. I want to make sure that this story ends the right way, because the Mt. Gox story isn't over. It's been in bankruptcy for 5 years. You know, this has impacted, you know, Mt. Gox has had over 1 million customers, over 120,000 active customers at the time, 24,000 creditors that have, you know, filed claims as part of the bankruptcy process. So this has been affecting a lot of people's lives. And for a lot of them, this is their most important asset. You know, I hate to say this because it's so negative, but people have killed themselves likely over this. Marriages have been ruined over this. People have lost their homes over this. You know, those early adopters that made a big bet early on because they had strong convictions about the potential of Bitcoin. You know, this Mt. Gox has, you know, has a lot of victims, a lot of people's lives that have been very negatively impacted. And the overall industry, I think, has been set back 2 or 3 years as a result of this. You know, I think Mt. Gox is the reason we had that bear market in 2014, 15, and into 16. Mt. Gox is the primary culprit, not the sole culprit, but the primary culprit. Fast forward to where we are now, 5 years later, you know, the story is not over. And this can end like Lehman Brothers. This can end like Bear Stearns. And Bitcoin and blockchain can look no better than the traditional financial system. Or, again, this story is not over. We can still write the ending of this story. How would we as an industry like this story to end? Do we want to look different than the traditional financial system? If so, we have the ability to do so. You know, let's create an optimal outcome for creditors. Let's give them the best outcome possible. Let's try and write a story that has a happy ending. And as part of that, I'd like to see the exchange relaunched. I'd like to see the rise of Mt. Gox, the fall of Mt. Gox. And I'd like to see the Phoenix, like, you know, rising out of the ashes, come back again. So that when we tell our story, you know, our story has a different ending. Our story is, look, creditors got all of this, you know, with a, call it a stretch goal of creditors getting everything back. Creditors being made whole. I mean, that's the story I'd like to go on stage and be able to tell. I'd like to be able to say, why is Bitcoin different? Well, when Bitcoin had its problem, when Mt. Gox failed, when we had our Lehman Brothers, all of the customers and all of the, you know, constituents had a happy ending. That's how Bitcoin is different. And so I'll stop there because that's been a pretty long summary already.
No, I love that. I absolutely love that. I I wasn't specifically around and like heavily involved in the crypto space during Mt. Gox, so I did not know all of those details. It's really, really interesting. And what I'm really curious about is what kind of impact is this going to have on the space as a result of the creditors getting this money? Like what impact does that have on the space, and what impact does it have on the whole future of cryptocurrency?
Yeah. So first and foremost, there's 24,000 victims. So first and foremost, the victims, you know, getting the beginning of their restitution, right? Getting what they deserve, getting what they're owed. So that's an important thing, you know, making sure that the victims are taken care of so they can begin to heal and their lives can, you know, improve in the way that they deserve for the risks that they have taken. For the overall industry, it changes the narrative. Again, so many people, the first time they heard of Bitcoin, they heard of it in the context of Mt. Gox, and not a pretty story, an awful story about how Bitcoin is bad, Bitcoin isn't secure, Bitcoin isn't safe, Bitcoin is risky, you know, all of those negative perceptions. And so many people's first perception of Bitcoin was negative. To be able to go back and to right that wrong, to change that narrative, and that narrative being, yeah, you heard about Bitcoin with Mt. Gox failing. Guess how that story ended? Creditors, the victims got what they were owed, and we're still kicking. We're still alive. Bitcoin is different. Bitcoin is not your old financial system. Bitcoin is something new, something improved, something that's community-based, something that's decentralized, something that is different than what you know. You should come back and take another look at this. We are not what you think we are. And that, I think, is a very powerful story. I think that's a very powerful message. We have the power to change the narrative. And the narrative matters. The media has not been our friend. You know, they, when we're having a good run, oh yeah, we get some nice press of, you know, when Lambo, when Moon, which is not how we want to be perceived either. But they are very, very quick to constantly, you know, criticize and sensationalize and vilify, you know, our industry. Definitely recommend, you know, everyone to, you know, read about and learn about Joseph Campbell and the hero's journey. I'm a storyteller. And I think this is, as an industry, our opportunity to tell our story, to tell a story of a hero's journey. You know, that's how all films are made, how all great stories are written. And if we want to tell our story and we want that message to resonate with people in a way that's impactful, let's tell a great story. And I think this is it.
I love it. I absolutely love it. And that even kind of like leads into other topics such as like the future of cryptocurrency. You know what I mean? If we're going to change the narrative around Bitcoin, if we're going to change the narrative around the whole space as a whole, and I like specifically what you said there, because what you're talking about is for example, we'll just look at the 2007, 2008 financial crisis with the banks. The narrative never changed. There was never like this resolution to the story where the banks got what they deserved and the people that were hurt in the process were solved, were paid back for their pain.
Yeah, no one went to jail. No one was even punished.
Exactly.
No one was even punished. Yeah, that story has no ending. And the media doesn't talk about that very much, but this little tiny thing called Bitcoin, you know, is always getting kicked when it's down.
Exactly. And what you're saying pretty much is that by solving this Mt. Gox or coming to a conclusion with this Mt. Gox situation and coming to a conclusion in as much of a positive light as possible, we are showing the world that we are different. We're showing the world that this community is driven to make a different impact on the financial world or any other part of the world by closing loose ends and tying up loose ends and making sure that it's done in the most positive and beneficial way as possible for the people who are the victims and the people who got hurt.
Yeah, because that's the big difference. The financial system is a bunch of businesses that are motivated by, you know, personal gain, you know, selfish incentives. We are a community. You know, that's what makes us so different. We are a community of game changers. We are a community of people that are trying to build a better future for all of us, because our system is built on an open source philosophy. You know, we build open source systems which require having open minds and hopefully open hearts. And this is a community that cares. You know, this is that's why we're different. So we have to do more than just talk about how we're different. We have to be able to point to results and be able to demonstrate how those differences produce different results and different outcomes. Just one thing, you know, if we're going to move off of that subject, for anyone listening, you know, if you want to know more, you can go to Gox Rising, goxrising.com, and you can check out, you know, what the Phoenix has to say.
I love it. That's super interesting. That's really interesting, man. And yeah, as we are moving off of that topic a little bit, let's just get into a very basic question of where do you think this is going in the next 5-10 years? And we're just going to talk about specifically with cryptocurrency. Are you a believer that Bitcoin is the new gold standard? Are you a believer that it's going to be utilized more of a currency or both? How do you see the next 5-10 years playing out in the space?
Well, I believe that the space itself is going to change our reality in ways bigger than I can even describe. I believe that this is so much more than just our financial system. We're creating the new internet. We're creating an entirely new operating system for how we interact as a species, not just with each other, but machines and technology. I mean, this is the foundation. You know, we are laying the foundation of our future. It's such a big deal. Now, specific to things like Bitcoin, I don't know if Bitcoin is the Friendster, the MySpace, or the Facebook, or the Instagram. I don't know. Obviously, I'm a huge supporter of Bitcoin. I'm still chairman of the Bitcoin Foundation and support Bitcoin in every way I possibly can. And that includes all of the forks, as much as some of it frustrates me. And even the personalities that support some of these projects, because I'm chain agnostic. I do not believe in maximalism of any kind. I believe that, being a maximalist of any one coin, you know, my coin is better than your coin, my chain is better than your chain, is the equivalent of religious fundamentalism. And we've learned over thousands of years that that doesn't serve us, that does not work. If anyone succeeds in making the world a better place, we all win. So, you know, please keep innovating, keep trying, you know, try to be nice, try to be kind, try to listen, try to teach, try to do things in the right way, operate, you know, with integrity, all the things that, you know, I want, but those are the projects I do my best to support, are those that are walking and acting in a place of integrity. I continue to be chain agnostic because I don't know who, what, where, how, when, why, which projects are going to, deliver the change. But I know as an ecosystem, as a space, as a broader community of people, what is going to happen. And I do what I can to help those people that are doing things the right way. You know, I support them, you know, in service to the best of my abilities.
And what do you think is going to happen, right? So let's get into like a little bit more of the meta conversation here and talk about even the impact of blockchain, Bitcoin, cryptocurrency, all of this stuff on the world as a whole. So in my point of view, in my perspective, we're obviously at a very, very interesting point in humanity. right? So we've, over the last X amount of years, 20, 30, 40 years, we've had a whole boom of technology. Technology has allowed us to become more interconnected. It's allowed us to create conversations quicker, learn information faster. We're starting to see it in the financial realm with Bitcoin and things like that, where we can send money peer-to-peer to each other. But the matter of fact is we're also at a very conflicting point with our planet, right? So humans living on the planet have been, for lack of a better word, destroying it. We won't survive much longer in the pathways that we're creating with war, hatred, and all of these things combined. And I know we're kind of getting onto a topic here that's a little bit deeper than I normally go on these podcasts, but I think you're someone who I want to go there with. I want to have this conversation with. How do you think Bitcoin, how do you think cryptocurrency, blockchain, how do you think these things are going to have an impact on the way that we as humanity are interacting with the world? How does this play a role in this kind of meta game that's and meta story that's going on right now on Earth?
Wow, yeah. Oh, so much pain. It's so sad. If you just stop and step back and take a look at the state of things, taking a look at the world, looking at where we are, in a wake up, we are destroying this world, and we're doing it rapidly. We're running out of time. Every day, things are happening that are, for the most part, irreversible. That's why we're here. That's why we're doing what we're doing. These systems of decentralization, these new systems that over time are going to change the status quo, are showing up exactly when the Earth needs it, exactly when we need it. This isn't any coin incidence. I don't like to use the word coincidence. I say coin incidence. It's not a coin incidence that this is happening now. This is the response. This is not just an opportunity for people to make money. When I say we're building the infrastructure that's going to, change things, that's exactly what we're doing, exactly as we need it. We're running out of time. And so, for people that haven't followed this space closely, this is not just a new technology. This is not just a new investment opportunity. What's going on here is we are laying the foundations to save our world, to save our species. It's forget about, just the impact of the technology itself. That's what these systems are, to distribute power, with new systems of governance. To bring power back to the people, to do things in a different way. It's very important, get involved.
It's very important, man.
Yeah, it's very important. As I like to say, it's not just about money. And if you take the word money, if you take the M and the Y, the first and last letter, the M and the Y out of money, if you take the my out of money, the I out of money, the me out of money, the three letters left in the middle are O-N-E, one. When you take the my out of money, you're left with one, because we are all one. One connected system, not just the people of the planet, but the Earth and everything on it. We are all one system that lives or dies together.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think that that's kind of also one of the interesting things being in myself, being very much into spirituality, very much into psychology and psychedelics and understanding how all of this is connected. I've been into that. I've been doing that for years now, and I really, really enjoy seeing the connection between these things, Brock, because it's super interesting to me how as we create Bitcoin, we are also creating at the same exact time a giant supercomputer that is connected at all over the world at every single second and every single minute, which mirrors exactly what you are saying in terms of the interconnectivity of us as human beings upon this planet. It's kind of like we are building technology that mirrors how reality is working. It's very, very interesting for me to see that. It's very interesting for me to see that. And even beyond that, I know it's not about money, but the interesting thing is that I think that Bitcoin and cryptocurrency, if we're going to talk about it from a financial standpoint and from an investment standpoint, what it is doing is it's moving and changing the tide of things. It's allowing at least to a maybe just a small degree, but to a degree, the financial power to switch hands at the moment. And I know that it's not all about money, but to a degree, this is actually a really good thing. And I say that because I think that a lot of the younger generation and a lot of people that haven't really been integrated into the systems that have been built upon this planet, I think a lot of those people see the damage that's being created, Brock. I think they see the fact that the earth is being hurt by our actions, and they want to create a change. I've met many, many young people who want to create a change, but they have no basis to create a change, whether it be due to ideas or things like that. But the majority of them don't have a basis to create a change because of finance. They want to create a change, but they don't know how to create enough financial stability within their own life to take care of themselves. And then from being able to take care of themselves to create a massive impact on the world. And I know I'm rambling a little bit, but I think that is while the money and the financial part of it, it's not all about making money. I 100% agree. I do believe that the tides are turning and they're turning in a good way. I think that the change is being made and it's, I think we're going to see some major impact and some major things change over the next 10, 15, 20 years. I'm excited.
Well, I mean, if you want to get into, you know, some of the interesting reasons why, I mean, our solar system runs on a 26,000 year cycle. And we've just hit the end of our 26,000 year cycle. This is why the Mayan calendar ends in the year 2012. But it's actually a 50 year process. We've been through 32 years of the 50 year, you know, end of the calendar. There's still 18 years left. Yeah, if you want to get into the, you know, astrology, you know, and call it the astral.
That's awesome, man. That's awesome. Yeah, I mean, I would personally love to get into that, but I don't know if my audience is going to like really dive into and understand and comprehend all of that stuff. But man, it's been such a pleasure having you on here. Can we just end with one final little part of I want to know a little bit about what you're working on in Puerto Rico specifically right now. I know that you have called that home. I don't know if you still call it home, but I know it plays a big role in your life. I know it plays a very big role even in the cryptocurrency realm, and a lot of people have been moving there. So what's going on there right now? What's exciting you about Puerto Rico, and what's kind of your thought process around that?
You know, Puerto Rico is still very much my home. I spend about half my time there, which is a lot of my time. I've never spent, you know, I've been a digital nomad for a very long time. And so I normally am not in any one place for more than a month a year. I've kind of lived out of a suitcase for a very, very long time, trying to kind of be everywhere at once, like a bee pollinating the world with, seeds of knowledge. But Puerto Rico is, my kind of main focus. It takes up more of my time than any other individual project, because it takes up about half of my physical time in terms of where I'm geographically situated. But also it's having me learn all sorts of things I've never learned before. Because the Puerto Rico thing is not just a blockchain thing. So I'll spend a moment just telling you kind of the why. Wherever I go in the world, lots of very, very competent and capable people show up wherever I go. Doesn't matter where I go on the planet. People get on planes, they fly there, they come to see me, they come to consult me, they ask for help. And these are people with lots and lots of intellectual capital, human capital, financial capital, spiritual capital. And so realizing that wherever I go, people will follow, that I'm a vortex of sorts. I could be in San Francisco, I could be in New York, I could be in London, I could be in Hong Kong. You know, I love all of those cities very much. But what kind of impact is that having? And so when realizing that wherever I go, you know, some people will follow, and people that can make a difference, game changers, that turned into an obligation. It became a great responsibility that I hadn't realized, you know, was a responsibility of mine. And so I said, well, I get the message. If I have this power, I need to go put it to work. I need to put it into service to hopefully make a positive impact in the world. And so I said, okay, well, where am I going to go test this experiment? Where am I going to go and see if by moving there, I can positively impact a place? And there's a lot of places in the world that need help. And I used to go to Puerto Rico as a teenager. And then, as I said, I started the first crypto bank. We started the first crypto bank, Noble Bank, in 2014. And so I became familiar with Puerto Rico. And, Puerto Rico was kind of always on my mind. And I also became more knowledgeable about Puerto Rico. Most people don't actually know this because it's almost been written out of the history books. But when Christopher Columbus sailed across the Atlantic in 1492, he first set up shop in Puerto Rico in 1493. That became the headquarters of the New World. So all of Europe's influence on the New World started in Puerto Rico. That's where, you know, ground zero. Think of it as 9/11, the Twin Towers. The original impact of Europe's influence on all of North and South America and all of the Caribbean began in Puerto Rico in 1493. It wasn't his first stop, but that's where they set up shop, because the indigenous people of the Caribbean were known as the Taino people. And that was where they were headquartered, and that's because it's the southernmost point of the Bermuda Triangle. And so that's where they set up shop. And so, you know, I'm a student of history, and I go, wow, if this is where, you know, the damage began, if this is where the impact on the indigenous people of the Americas started, that seems like an interesting place for the healing, you know, for the healing to begin, you know, as things go full circle. And so that was resonating with me in a big way. And so I started telling, you know, friends in 2016 and 17, I said, you know, Puerto Rico seems like a good place for us to move at some point. And, you know, I told some friends we should move in December 2018, probably about a dozen friends. And then the hurricane hit. And after seeing Hurricane Maria hit and the impact that was having on Puerto Rico, I said, well, this isn't convenient. I was kind of planning to make this move in December 2018, but seems like now's the time to go. As everyone was leaving and everyone was moving in out, you know, we were moving in. And the idea was, and I have no idea what I'm doing. I'm, you know, so in over my head. But the, you know, the fundamental motivation is like, go and be helpful. And so the hurricane, you know, Puerto Rico's mostly recovered from that. The center of the island still has some needs, but, you know, there's the power works. The power's fine. It's beautiful. It's wonderful. It's the most underappreciated part of the United States. I mean, it is so beautiful. And just a couple of facts and figures. Puerto Ricans, on average, have more bachelor degrees than any other part of the United States, meaning they're the most educated. Puerto Rico has the most artists per capita of anywhere in the United States, meaning they're the most creative. Puerto Rico has so much talent. It also has like the most incredible weather, you know, the most incredible beaches everywhere. It has a rainforest. It's the only part of the United States with a rainforest. I mean, it's, if you haven't been, go check it out. It is, you know, one of the most incredible places on the planet. It's got bioluminescent bays, you know, three bioluminescent bays. There's, you know, only a handful of those in the world. And most of them, not most of them, but almost a majority of them are in Puerto Rico. It is the enchanted island. It's magical, magical, like very few places on the planet. You know, and as I like to say, Puerto Rico, that in a lot of ways was the first state, but isn't the 51st state, has become the forgotten state. And so fast forward to right now, what is the problem with Puerto Rico? The problem with Puerto Rico is it's been conquered and there's been conquistadors and things for 500 years. You know, this is a place that has been through a lot of pain, a lot of suffering. And, you know, the people have so much talent. The Puerto Rican people are so beautiful, so wonderful, so full of potential. But, you know, they've been stepped on for so long that, you know, they don't fully acknowledge how wonderful they are, how much talent they truly have. They don't believe in themselves as much as they should. And that's not true of all people. Obviously, there are a lot of powerful Puerto Ricans that understand who and what they are and, you know, are, you know, coming into their full potential. But a lot of that's because of that historical sort of just the challenges that they've had to endure. The other big issue is what I call the brain drain. The Puerto Ricans, with the intellectual capital, with the human capital, with the financial capital, with the spiritual capital, you know, the people with the means have been the first to leave. So the diaspora, you have like 6 million Puerto Ricans living in the United States, and there's only 3 million people left in Puerto Rico. And the ones that have moved into the U.S., it's not any fault of theirs. They've left because of a lack of opportunity for the most part in Puerto Rico. But when a place has this sustained brain drain of the people that possess, you know, most of the, you know, capital of all in all of its forms are always leaving, that's a big problem. And then you have the same problem with the youth. The number 15, the 15th best engineering school in the United States is in Puerto Rico. And so, you know, Facebook and Google and, you know, Exxon and NASA and such have near full-time recruiters there because there's almost no good jobs. But the people are so talented. You know, Puerto Rico's greatest export are people. You know, Puerto Rico's main export is human talent, and they have a lot of it. The problem is most of that talent keeps leaving. And so when a place is consistently losing its best and its brightest, both in terms of the youth and the adults, you know, long term, that is a big problem. That is the main problem and the main thing that afflicts Puerto Rico. And so what is it that we're doing? We're bringing human talent, intellectual talent, financial capital, spiritual capital. You know, obviously there's not that many of us, you know, maybe there's 500 or 1,000 of us that have moved. There's a new person moving almost every day. So, I mean, it's definitely become a movement, but we're never going to be a meaningful percentage of any of the population there. That's an impossibility. But what we are able to do is we're bringing capital. There had been no Puerto Rican startups that had ever, you know, raised money before this, even though there's lots of really talented Puerto Ricans in Silicon Valley and in New York working on startups, tons of them, really amazing engineers. But if you were a Puerto Rican with a dream, you know, an entrepreneurial idea, a vision, the only way for that dream to become a reality is by leaving Puerto Rico. You had to leave. because the tools were not there. You didn't have any angel investors. You didn't have any experienced entrepreneurs or mentors. You didn't have, you know, the co-working facilities, the accelerator programs, the venture capital. None of those things have existed. And so we've brought an abundance of those things to Puerto Rico. And Puerto Ricans have been starting, you know, co-working facilities, accelerators, co-living facilities. You know, we're bringing angels and we're bringing mentors. And so there's been now two Puerto Rican startups late last year that raised over $1 million each. I think we're going to see a handful of more of those this first half of this year. And so for the first time ever in Puerto Rico, if you have an entrepreneurial dream, that dream can become a reality. If you, you know, are a Puerto Rican entrepreneur, you no longer have to leave. And what that also means is that if you're a Puerto Rican entrepreneur living in New York and San Francisco, you can also go home. You know, tech jobs are starting to emerge. Startups, you know, are starting to happen. You know, and we might be able to begin reversing that trend of all the talent leaving and hopefully some of that talent returning. You know, if a quarter million, if 250,000 of the right Puerto Ricans go back to Puerto Rico, problem solved. Puerto Ricans have all the talent in the world. You know, if 25,000 really talented Puerto Ricans go home, that can, you know, be the thing that literally changes everything. And so, you know, there's a small group of us doing our little part and hopefully helping to facilitate that. Hopefully, you know, bringing about a little bit of that change that can lead to the big change that can only be done by Puerto Ricans. You know, but we're doing our little part, you know, hopefully building a little lighthouse, you know, in the world that can start to change this trend of the big cities getting bigger. I mean, if you look at a map of the world, what's been happening is California and New York have been getting bigger and bigger and bigger because all the talent around the world keeps getting sucked into these major cities and at the expense of all the little cities and the rest of the world. You know, now because of globalization and because of good communication systems, you shouldn't have to live in New York to have a great job, to be a part of, you know, the cutting edge, to be, you know, doing the most interesting things. You should be able to do that from anywhere now. And so one of the things that we need to be doing as people is we need to be leaving those big cities and going out into the world to make a difference, wherever that is, Puerto Rico or anywhere else. You know, these places are all struggling. And, you know, what we need to do is start to distribute that talent again all over the world. And I, for one, I'm naturally going to go pick, you know, nice places to begin with because other people want to go to nice places, Puerto Rico being one of them. But there's a lot of nice places around the world that need help right now. And one of the things that I would encourage people to do, it's lower cost of living, all sorts of, there's lots of compelling reasons to make that move. You know, but San Francisco doesn't need us. New York doesn't need us. London doesn't need us, you know. You know, get out there in the world and do your part is the, at least the motto I live by.
I love it, brother. I love it. So for everybody listening, goxrising.com is where you're going to find out about the Mount Gox things. And Brock, where else can they learn about you or any other venture that you might be working on right now?
So I'm trying to do a better job of communicating, you know, using technology, but you can go to brockpierce.io. That has some information and, you know, we hopefully we'll keep that more up to date. Certainly for anyone that is an EOS holder, we just launched the Brock Pierce One proxy. So if you're not actively, you know, monitoring all the block producers and voting for block producers that are best in class, that are doing, you know, serving the community to the best of their abilities, these proxy services exist so that you vote for a proxy, which then votes for you. And we stay on top of that. So you can check that out also on brockpierce.io. You can find me on Twitter, which is just at Brock Pierce. And I hope to, you know, continue to do a good job of communicating with everyone. And I live my life in service. I'm, you know, here to try and help everybody I can, and specifically those that are in service first and foremost.
I love it, man. I love it. Thank you so much for coming on, man. Seriously, like we dove a little bit deep, and I appreciate you you opening up and sharing a little bit about your perspective on everything. And yeah, thank you for all the information.
Thank you for having me. It's been a real pleasure. Hope to do it again.
I'm sure we will. I would love that as well. All right, everybody. As you know, this is Evolvement, the financial podcast. We talk about Bitcoin, cryptocurrency, and a future of our financial systems. We will catch you next time. Thanks again, Brock. Peace.
Peace.
This has been the Evolvement Podcast with your boy, Nye. Thanks for tuning in. Head over to evolvement.io for updates and join us next week for an all-new episode. Peace.